Charlie, give it here, she ordered. Accio jewelry, said Maximilian. The shiny object flew from the bird's beak and into his hand. An earring, he observed, shaking his head. I hope the owner wasn't wearing it when Charlie took it.
Hello, once again, and welcome back to the Remedial Magic Podcast. My name is Brady, and as always, I'm joined by my brother Baylor and our good friend Delbert, and I'm just going to start this one off with a hot take. Anna Chu is racist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think, while it seems learned, she is a racist, and I don't like her anymore.
Wow.
I also have a question.
Yeah.
Can we use the term she uses, or is that like a no-no term? Because I've heard it used pretty frequently when it's talked about in historical contexts. But I don't know if it's okay to just use, like, even when discussing the book.
I have no idea, but I am going to say it in the context of the quote that she says it in.
Right.
I think that's fine, but regardless, Anna Chu is a racist, and I don't like her.
Yeah.
What in the world?
I have a feeling that Tomo's probably also a racist, and that it's a very back-and-forth conflict.
Something like that. But regardless, this is the Remedial Magic Podcast. How's everybody doing today?
I'm doing great, you know? Just
not as good.
Just, I don't know. I was that hot take was unexpected, so I'm reacting.
That's where
slowly.
I'm at. I was having a great time, and then you come in with that intro, and now my day's ruined.
I don't know, man. She's a racist.
For the record, I still like Anna Chu. She's only, what, 12? If she was, like, 62, I'd probably hate her.
Sure.
12-year-old still figuring it out.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair.
That's probably a good, yeah. I mean, you said, you know, I've said some things when I was younger that I didn't even know what they meant, and it turns out they were offensive. So, you know, I think everybody can learn and grow.
We'll address this a little bit more when the time comes. But first, I wanted to remind everybody that we are discussing the fan fiction called Alexandra Quick and the Lands Below, book 2 in a series of fan fictions written by Inverarity. This week, we'll be discussing chapters, I believe, 19 and 20 of the book. Coming off, hot off the heels of our discussion last week about chapter 17 and 18, where we finally met Abraham Thorne, and Alex finally tells her mom that she can do magic, and rather than getting any true parental support, Alex is once again left to fend for herself. So I can only imagine what this set of chapters is going to entail. But before we get there, have you guys heard any Harry Potter news this week? Anything important you want to talk about?
I have some hot off the presses Harry Potter news from 2005.
Excellent.
Yeah. So perhaps considered history at this point, but Brady, you and I are taking a trip this winter, going to a concert in a faraway destination, and we were kind of thinking about maybe catching a show at said destination, and I have found a show for us. It is called Potted Potter.
Oh, dude.
All 7 Harry Potter books in 70 minutes.
You may not remember this, but the first time we went to San Francisco together, I tried to convince you fools to go to that show.
I don't remember this, and I'm still not sure that that would be my choice, but it does sound like a good one.
I think it looks awesome. There's another Harry Potter show like that called Puffs that's about the Hufflepuff, the group of students that are Hufflepuffs during Harry's time. It's like the story from their perspective. It also looks pretty incredible. But if you want to go to Potted Potter while we're down there for When We Were Young Fest, count me right in.
Ooh, and now that we've spoiled exactly what we're there for, time to set up a meet and greet?
Yeah, the first official Remedial Magic Podcast meet and greet will happen on October 22nd. We unfortunately will not be there, but you can meet with a close representative of ours All you need to do is walk down the strip shouting the name Tanner, and perhaps, maybe, you'll find him.
Wow.
We promise he'll have merch.
I was also going to say that I just won't be there with you guys or at this impromptu meet and greet. So, unfortunately, your guys' favorite voice won't be able to meet you, but maybe one of these days.
It's very thematic, considering you haven't been with us to record the podcast in months now.
Yeah, that's a fair point, and I got to fit this in because this is a tight window, but still recording 3 hours after you guys do seems to be working out pretty good.
The conversations flow very well.
Indeed.
I will say, a little bit on that same train of thought, in a couple weeks, Delbert, we should be able to get back into our studio, and our voices will sound clean and crisp once again, so that's very exciting.
Then the shoes become on the other feet as we have the voice of the people, and Baylor's modest setup is thrown into the past.
That's true. There's not a lot of soundproofing where Baylor's recording, so.
Indeed. Indeed. Just a mixer. That's it.
Also, I don't know where your setup is, but I hope that it's in the undercarriage of your house, or your parents' house.
The undercarriage?
I don't know what it's called. But it's like gravel underneath the floor that you can go down into.
That is traditionally called a crawl space.
Nice. Walter White's crawl space was not made of pebbles, so I didn't know if it was the same terminology.
I always tried to convince my grandparents, prior to my parents owning that house, that we should set up an indoor air gun shooting range down there.
There wasn't enough room to stand.
Yeah, but you can, like, sit and lay down and stuff.
That's fair.
It's a great crawl space. Shout out to crawl spaces everywhere, but especially that one. That's the most comfortable one I've ever been in.
And the most terrifying one from Breaking Bad.
True. Yeah. What a bizarre diatribe that was. Is there something else you had to say about Harry Potter news, Delbert?
I did. Well, kind of. It's more about our email, but it's not an email. So I'm really just going down a rabbit hole here. Because Inverarity attacked us, personally.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So, on the Alex Quick Discord, in the Remedial Magic Podcast chat channel, Inverarity, the author of the podcast, or of the fan fiction we've been reading for the last year, commented and said that he is caught up with us again. So, awesome there. Yeah. Good to see. And secondly, definitely no Larry Alex Shippers on this podcast. Now, if I recall, Brady, you said, what is the point of Larry?
So, I did say that.
I'm going to go to you first.
My response to that particular comment would be, why would we ever ship those two together? Definitely no Larry and Alex Shippers on this podcast. Why the hell would we be?
Baylor?
He's a jerk.
Yeah, there's never been one instance that I've been reading this, that we've been discussing it, either on or off the podcast, that I've thought to myself, oh, wow, Alex and Larry are definitely setting up a relationship here in the future. That's like Malfoy and Hermione getting together. Like, it's illogical at this point. Maybe something will change, but right now, no.
Malfoy Hermione is something very much sought after by the fanfiction community.
Oh, it is, and it's a problem.
That being said, Alex Larry, no. Hardest pass of my whole life.
Can I take a stance on this that's going to get me just banned from fanfiction in general?
Sure.
Can we stop shipping 12-year-olds?
Yeah, it's a great point. It's a great point.
I mean, I get that people are interested in it, but she's 12 and he's like 14. Like, they're literally, they couldn't drive with a farmer's permit yet.
All I have to say about Larry and Alex and anybody who thinks that it would ever be a good idea for them to do anything romantically involved together is, get out. I'm okay if our listener count goes down by one or two or whatever.
See, and like my thing too is like, I had a quote-unquote, air quotes, girlfriend when I was 12. We held hands twice and broke up.
Yeah, that shit's not legit at all.
So, like, I get that some people do enter relationships that are, like, somewhat meaningful at those ages, but also that's not, like, an important thing to their character most of the time.
It's, I don't know, Inverardi. I think you've lost a point on that one.
Inverardi, you're writing book 6. You're almost done. Time to go back in and finally focus on the relationship aspect now that she's like 16 or something. Then it makes sense.
Sure. However, as we speak about relationships in the Alex Quick world, the first chapter we talk about today is basically only about that.
True.
So, you know.
And honestly, I don't have a problem with this one because it's just like a comical thing. Like, this makes sense for like a 12-year-old, 13-year-old. But shipping, as it's put, I'll leave that until they're, you know, close to 18 at the minimum.
Yeah. This might be the hottest take of all time in fan fiction, but I think shipping in general in fan fiction is one of the most toxic parts of fan fiction.
It ruined a lot of fanfics for me, and some I'll never read now, because when I originally saw, like, looked up fan fiction, it was sorted by who's paired with who. And I just didn't care that that's what it was. Like, I just wanted a good story.
I completely agree.
I will say, though, I started dating my wife when I was 15, so, you know, that's crazy things happen.
Older than Larry.
At least at the age of 15, you have the potential to be, like, through puberty. You know what I mean?
That's fair. And books are very different, too, because you're making decisions for other people, basically, you know.
I also think now is a great time to point out that even though we've talked about 15 and close to 18, I think our official podcast stance is leave people under 18 alone if you're above 18.
Well, sure. I mean, I don't know where this conversation is going. I'm not for shipping anybody. Back to the original point.
Yeah.
Would I ever ship Larry with Alex? Absolutely not.
Me neither.
It's heinous to even think about.
My thing is, I can't think of anybody to ship Alex with, especially during books 2, and maybe 3, and maybe 4, because it's just too young to even think about.
Also, Larry thinks he's cool by smoking cigarettes.
Yeah.
Get him out of here. What a joker. You know what I mean? He's like the worst type of student to have in your class, I think. You know what I mean?
Here's a hot take. You can't be anti-Muggleborn and then you use Muggle cigarettes. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Kyle Albo.
Kyle Albo.
Wow.
What a deep cut.
That must be some spoiler.
Yeah. Well, no, we'll leave that one behind the scenes. moving on.
Oh, I see what's going on.
Moving on. Our review count hasn't gone up in a couple weeks, and that's really the fault of you people, the listeners, and we do have social media that you can find in the link tree that's listed in the description of our podcast, as well as an email address that is remedialmagicpodcast@gmail.com, where you can send us emails if you want to reach out to us. But if you think Larry and Alex should end up together, definitely don't do that. Stay away. What has happened to this podcast?
The last two weeks have been insane.
But regardless, as I said, we're talking about chapters 19 and 20 this week of Alexander Quick and The Lands Below. And I think it's probably my turn to do the summary, so I'll do that starting right now. Starting with chapter 19, which is titled Dangerous Hearts, Alex reveals her devious plan that she talked with David about on the phone at the end of chapter 18, and that plan is for her to pretend to be David's girlfriend to try to make Angelique jealous. And the only person, literally the only person who thinks this is a good idea is Alex. Not even David. And I feel like David got bullied into going along with it. Alex and Anna have a deep talk where Alex tells Anna about what happened over Christmas break. And Anna tells Alex that Japanese people will steal anything. So really good stuff there. Max comes in with some Muggleborn hate and tells Alex that David is unsuitable to be dating because he's a Muggleborn. And then they play a new magical game that is reminiscent of a different magical game from a different series entirely. We then get into chapter 20, which is titled Charlie the Thief. We see Alex do some flying dueling with Max, Martin, and Beatrice, which I think seems really, really cool. Looks like it would be a really fun thing to watch on a movie theater screen or something like that. David breaks off his fake relationship with Alex, proceeds to get kissed by Darla, and then maybe or maybe not cursed by Darla, depending on your perspective. And then Charlie arrives on scene with another strange coin in his beak. However, this is not a Mors Mortis coin. It is something else entirely. So that's the summary of chapters 19 and 20. And I'll say, while these chapters were fairly long, and you guys can give me your opinion here too, but while these chapters were fairly long, I didn't find them to be that full of really seeming important information necessarily.
The only thing that really was interesting to me was the very end of the second chapter, chapter 20. But
that's kind of what I think too. It was like a nice little bit of a transition period because we had had so many chapters in a row of like critical information, and now it's transitioned out of that a little bit for a couple of chapters, and then it picks up again at the end of chapter 20.
Yeah, this, I mean, this is the kind of chapter that we had like 10 to 12 in a row of during the first book, and we were just like on the precipice of something amazing happening for so long. And it makes sense, because like you said, there's been so much stuff going on in the first part of this book. Like, we've introduced new characters, we've introduced new people, themes, new plans with like the Mors Mortis Society and whatever Max is up to. So it makes sense to take this break. And honestly, most of both of these chapters are dedicated to the David, Angelique, Alex thing going on with the fake relationship. And I think it's nice. It's like a nice little pause before we get towards the second half of the book, where I assume things will get crazy again.
Yeah, I thought these chapters were easier to read than the last few. You could sort of smoothly work your way through these a little bit better because you weren't unpacking so much information constantly as like we have been. But I want to talk about this plan Alex came up with, where she just tells David that we should pretend to be dating to make Angelique jealous. And that sounds like a 12-year-old through and through. You know, that sounds like something a 12-year-old would do. So that part isn't that interesting. But what is interesting is how every person at the school, except for Alex, thinks this is a terrible idea. Everybody does. I was reading this just thinking to myself that this is one of the only times where Alex has truly been on an island by herself.
I'd say the only maybe exception would be Anna, just because Anna seemed to enjoy what they were doing. But no, definitely, everybody was pretty strict, you know, with what they were doing, I guess. Like, with their being against what they were doing.
I have a request.
Okay.
Of you, Brady.
What?
Do you remember book one? It was a peaceful time. And then you made me and Baylor sing a troublesome song?
I remember, yeah.
I would like for you to take two of these quotes from the Constance and Forbearance twins and read them out with your best accent.
I'm happy to do that. And I put all these quotes in here because I think they're incredible.
Oh, I agree.
But I also wanted to discuss one of them with you guys and see if we could figure out just what the hell it means. So Constance and Forbearance are basically telling Alex she's being an idiot with this whole plan to fake date David. And they say some things in their Ozarker style that are pretty funny. However, one of the quotes is, "Y'all fixin' to pull some Dido from the movies, playful-like?" It's a question. What does that even mean?
Isn't it?
Did either of you look this up?
Isn't it Ditto? Like, Ditto? Copycat? Like, replicate?
Isn't that spelled with two T's?
Or I thought it was spelled differently, but I guess it could be that. Y'all fixin' to pull some Dido or Ditto, I don't know, from the movies, playful-like? What do we suppose this means exactly? Because this is, for context, they say this prior to knowing what's going on. They just know that David and Anna or Alex are planning something.
Well, I just Googled it, and it's an informal slang in North America, obviously. And it just means a mischievous trick or prank.
Regardless of... I guess that makes sense. You're just trying to pull a prank from the movies. That's one thing. Do Constance and Forbearance watch a lot of movies?
They did take Muggle studies, or they were going to, or something, right?
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Maybe their whole class is like what Muggle sub-teachers do. And just throw on, like, they've just been watching Bill Nye the Science Guy in all their classes.
But I thought Muggle Tech doesn't work at school.
They make it work.
They did say that they would be watching a movie later this semester.
That's true. Class. They say they're watching a movie, and then one of them says, "I need a romance movie."
My other question is regarding, I guess, this quote and the Forbearance, or the Ozarkers in general, is they also got a camera from Alex for Christmas, and they apparently took and developed pictures from this camera. Am I to assume they knew how to deal with a disposable camera that a Muggle would send?
Now, I think in book one, Alex sends them calculators, right? And it notes that she, like, writes out the instructions on how to do it. So can we just assume that happened with the cameras as well?
I think we could.
I think, I don't know. You know, I think disposable cameras have the directions pretty plainly on them as well.
They typically do, but are Constance and Forbearance leaving their hauler deep in the Ozark Mountains to go to Walgreens down the road and get their disposable photos developed?
I hope so.
Or, yeah. I mean, we know there's magical photos too, so maybe it's the same process, and since it's not a magical camera, they still come out still.
Maybe.
But regardless, y'all fixin' to pull some Dido from the movies playful-like?
Also, now that you say that
legendary.
Wizards also have photos? What a terrible gift from Alex. I forgot that they have something to take pictures already, so it's just, here's our version.
It's just like, I don't know. Incredible, incredible quote. The other quotes that I wrote down, when they find out about what's going on, they start sending quotes that are, or saying things that are more mean, maybe, or whatever. First, they're disgusted, and one of them says, and paw on each other? All in front of everyone? to which David takes huge offense.
This is a long time coming.
David is not thrilled about the idea that he is pawing anyone in front of anyone. And then when they get the whole plan, one of them tells Alex, "That is the most plum bug-headed, bodacious, koozy, indecent," and then they trail off because they can't finish the quote. And I did want to talk about this one a little bit. We can sort of infer what bug-headed means.
Right.
However, bodacious? I thought bodacious was cool. I thought if you were telling somebody they got like a bodacious bod, it's because they got a rockin' bod, you know?
I don't know. It's too big a word for my small brain. My bug-headed brain.
Another word in this that I don't necessarily know the meaning of is koozie.
Now, I thought this was like a pretty offensive word, like meaning like whore. But maybe I'm wrong.
It could be. I don't know. Bailey, are you Googling this one for us as well?
I am attempting, yes. Let's see. Koozie.
Maybe I'm just mixing it with floozy? I don't really know.
Yeah, all I'm finding all I'm finding for the definition is an insulated sleeve for a drink.
Right. Ooh. I Googled slang, and it says, what does koozie mean in slang? Female genitals.
Koozie with a C, however, does mean a sexually attractive or promiscuous woman.
That is most likely.
Which is what I think I was thinking of. I don't know if the K makes it different or not.
That is most likely the correct explanation.
I hope it's not the Urban Dictionary definition that I just read.
Yeah, well, Urban Dictionary is not a reliable source.
You're right, but yikes.
And they also call Alex straw-headed, ornery, mule crazy. Which I think mule crazy is stubborn.
Yeah.
But Constance and Forbearance are not pleased. But that leads, these are some of the best lines they've had in the series so far.
Yeah. Incredible. I know I've said from very early on that they're like two of my favorite characters, and I love every time they come in like this. It's really fun.
So Alex hatches this ridiculous plan. David goes along with it. Nobody thinks it's a good idea, really. And we kind of get past it, which is nice. To be honest, it's not my favorite thing that's happened in this story so far. I don't really care about it. And then Alex and Anna get a chance to talk one-on-one. They're best friends. They're going to tell each other more than they're going to tell the group at large. And Alex tells Anna about how her mom reacted to her saying she's magical. And Anna's response is, I don't think she really knew what to say, necessarily.
It was almost like she was like, I thought I had it bad, but that's pretty bad too. You know, like that's probably worse than what I'm dealing with at home.
Yeah, right. Because she says something about how at least her mom like knows that she's magical, so she can talk to her about it, right? Whereas Alex's mom, Claudia, doesn't want to know any details about it whatsoever. And that's, I'm sure that doesn't feel good. The great thing about this little conversation is that Anna, in return, tells Alex, because Alex says, don't get in any more fights with Tomo, so you don't have to be in J-Rock anymore. Anna's response is, yeah, well, the Japs will steal anything they learn elsewhere and then claim they invented it.
Ouch.
Which is a quote from her father.
Right.
But what a quote it is. This is why I started this podcast off with such a hot take, but come on.
And we said this really early on in book one with the Jarvie and with how Darla acts around everyone. That this isn't stuff that people learn on their own. This is stuff they're picking up from their households. Like, Darla's probably kind of toxic because she comes from a pretty toxic family. Angelique's Jarvie is probably picking up some horrific slang while she's at home. And on top of that, Anna very clearly is picking up off what her father says, rather than off what she's actually interacted with.
Without question.
That's exactly what I thought, too, especially given, at least my interpretation, is that when Anna goes home, she doesn't really go other places. Like, she doesn't hang out with other people. You know, she's pretty much stuck at home. So, I don't know if she necessarily knows what her dad is saying is as wrong as what it actually is.
It's interesting. I think personally Anna is smarter than that, and she does realize it, and she does kind of double down here, because she goes on to explain that the Magikai are so stubborn, yada yada, whatever, that the only reason that they even joined the Confederation is because if they didn't, they would have been kicked out of the country. So while I do think she's picking this up at home, she is doubling down on it kind of in the same way that Darla is doubling down on practicing the dark arts a little bit. However, more interestingly, I think, is that true? Do you think they'd kick an entire ethnicity out of the country?
You know, I was just thinking this while you were talking and only like half listening to what you said, but you talked about the thing I was considering. We're not going to get most answers about historical wizard context from either Inverarity or J.K. Rowling or anybody else for that matter. But like in this universe, well, first off, I guess we should go to the Muggle universe in case people who aren't in America or weren't taught this growing up. We had an internment camp here in Wyoming during World War II where all the Japanese people were taken away from their homes on the West Coast, shipped out by train, and left in a camp near Cody.
That's true.
So, that's already horrible. But, not to like almost take away from it, but looking at the fictional aspect from the wizarding world, would there have been more of a reason for that to happen? Was that something with the Magikai? Or is that strictly left to the Muggle side? And I don't want to like pull away from the seriousness of what actually happened, but we also do this on the other side with like 1930s Germany and Grindelwald. We kind of relate those two together. So, I mean, I think we can look at it from both sides.
There is kind of a precedent in the wizarding world that's been established that Muggle events are sort of mirrored in the wizarding world as well.
Right.
And so there's definitely a good chance that this conversation about the Magikai leaving the Confederation and the country coincides similarly to the way that Japanese Americans were treated during World War II and stuff like that.
I personally kind of thought that it was going to be along the lines of, you know, like the voodoo magic and everything from the first book where it still exists in the Confederation's territory, but they aren't recognized as appropriate magic types or whatever, because they aren't the approved magic.
So you think rather than like expelling them from the borders, they just change their borders to cut out where they live?
No. I'm saying like there's unapproved magic, like voodoo magic and
right.
Some of the New Californians or whatever they're called. What they do isn't approved by the Confederation. So I think what I'm trying to get at, I guess, or how I understood this is that the Magikai, their traditions and everything weren't being recognized by the Confederation as the right stuff. So they had to basically assimilate with the Confederation or else, you know, they would probably be persecuted in physical ways like you're talking or, you know, legal ways or whatever else.
It's very interesting to think about because either way, whether it's just Anna exaggerating because she's a 12-year-old girl or whether this is true, there is a pretty serious rift. Like the Magikai just keep coming up as a reminder that if you don't agree with the Confederation, you're going to be painted as being against the country and against the people of the country. And we see that is very heavily reinforced in the way Anna speaks about the Magikai.
Absolutely. Well, it's also funny, too, because I wonder how Constance and Forbearance feel about this. Because as far as we know, the Ozarks are also like one of those areas that exist not really within the Confederation, from what we've been told so far. And we've seen David like attack the, I can't remember their names, but the older twins that
the Rash with Larry. Twins.
Yeah, and Constance and Forbearance get a little upset because he's using like generic slurs against them. So I almost wonder if the Ozarkers heard Anna saying, If they didn't join the Confederation, they would have been kicked out of the country, if that also, like, hurts the Ozarkers' feelings.
I think...
because they're also outsiders.
I think it would have to. Like, they must feel like outsiders, Constance and Forbearance, for many reasons. They're from the Ozarks. Almost nobody from the Ozarks gets to come to a traditional Confederation school. They have different traditions that they bring with them. And then their friends, without meaning to, are kind of offering backhanded compliments and insults from the shadows and things like that. And so I think Constance and Forbearance pay more attention to people at Charmbridge than anybody else that plays a big role in the story. And so I'm sure they hear this talk often, and there's no way they enjoy it. There's no way they like hearing this kind of thing being said, even if it's not directly about them or the Ozarks, because they share a similar role to like the Magi and people from Louisiana and stuff like that.
And the other thing too, on top of that, that I was just thinking is the Magi, or Tomo for instance, if she wanted to, she could probably just keep her head down and basically go throughout her day, like, avoiding a lot of this interactions and stuff. It seems like it's a rule, or at least some sort of custom, that the Ozarkers are wearing, like, full dresses and bonnets everywhere, so they're, like, displaying where they're from, too, so they can't really run from it in any fashion similar to what Tomo possibly could do.
It's true. They have a tough life.
Yeah.
I think it's an unfortunate circumstance of how the Confederation is, because in the Muggle world, our world, the real world, you know, you have different states, different cultures, whatever, but by design, maybe, or just how it is, it seems like the magical world is much more traditional and old-fashioned than perhaps its Muggle counterpart. And I think because of that, you have these little, especially in the Confederation, you have these little sects of different cultures and stuff, but instead of expanding and kind of being inclusive to other cultures, obviously probably some more than others, it's very we're from the Ozarks, or we're a new traditionalist, or we're from, you know, whatever Ben Journey was, I can't remember exactly, but It's very separated versus the real world that we're living in.
Yeah, I think I agree with what you're saying there as well. It's a very complicated situation, I think. It feels like the dynamics between the government of the Confederation and the people are fractured similarly to the way they are, just in real life, just in kind of in a different way. And I don't know. There's a lot of weird conversations being had, a lot of it because of this fake relationship that Alex and David are pretending to have currently. And something else that gets brought up by that is Max telling Alex that David is unsuitable for her to be dating. At first, it reads like he's saying that because David is African-American, right? Because David is black. However, he's saying that because David is Muggle-born, and a person of Alex's background shouldn't be stooping so low as to marry a Muggle-born, which is just another example. I think another bullet point on the list of evidence, I think, that Max is growing up in a situation where he's being trained or influenced in, like, a political manner based on who his father is and his usefulness to the current Confederation government as well.
The interesting thing for me is how prevalent this anti-Muggleborn sentiment still is in the Wizarding world. Like, we saw it, obviously, in the original series. That was in the 90s, and now we're in the late 2000s, 10 years later or more, well, 11 years, I guess, technically. And you're still dealing with this Muggle-born bias. And it's also surprising, given in the first book, there was such an emphasis on elvish rites, but I guess Muggles are below elves, house elves? It's an interesting dynamic that this Confederation takes, which honestly, given America, I mean, are we surprised?
It's interesting. I don't know. It's like, to be honest, I know that J.K. Rowling didn't write this story, but I blame a lot of the fact that there's still this anti-Muggleborn thing going on, and basically all fan fictions I've read that are post-Harry Potter, that are set in a world post-Harry Potter, I blame it on J.K. Rowling for not fixing that during the epilogue of the last book or whatever, right? Like, at the end of the Harry Potter series, all the problems that existed at the beginning were still there, essentially. And so that's still a very clear stepping stone for fan fiction authors to work from. And we see that reflected here as well.
Yeah. And I mean, if you want to get more in depth on that, here's a shameless plug. Go check out our interview with Bagsy Beetlethorne's author Leo, because we discussed that as well. But you're absolutely right. In the epilogue of Harry Potter, 19 years later, I believe, Harry's kid is like, I don't want to be in Slytherin. And that's like where the entire story started to be like very unfair. And it's still just the main problem with people going to school not wanting to be in that house. So yeah, I doubt that the Wizarding War in Europe really changed that much.
Yeah, so like in the context of the Wizarding World as it sits canonically, this anti-Muggleborn sentiment makes sense still, even now, to this day, that there's this idea that if you're not a pureblood wizard, you're not as deserving of status as somebody who is half-blood or Muggleborn, you know? And so it's, I don't know, it's just weird. It's weird to me that Max is coming up to his 12-year-old sister as a 17-year-old boy who should know that even if this is a real relationship, it's not, like, gonna last, most likely, and saying this to her, like, stop dating him, he's unsuitable.
I mean, to be fair, though, his father, who he knows at least a few times, it seems, has spoken to or whatever, went and met with Voldemort and came back, so I would not be surprised in the slightest if Abraham Thorne is also a blood purist.
Yeah, we really don't know his stance on that yet.
No, but we know Max's, and we know that he met with Voldemort willingly. Or maybe not willingly, but he met with Voldemort, so.
I will say the good thing going for Max is that, you know, Alex kind of cut him off and said, oh, because David's a mudblood or whatever. And then Max said, oh, I'd never dream of calling anybody that, not even thinking about it. So I guess that's a positive. But I definitely think there is a little bit of bias. And I, from my point of view, I kind of think it's more of a family line versus the bloodline. I know that these two are kind of intermixed because David is Muggleborn. But I think because he kind of talks, obviously, later this chapter or next chapter even maybe, he talks about Angelique's family. He talks about Darla's family. So it's almost much more about the family line versus blood status to Max anyways.
Well, I think I agree. I don't really think Max necessarily has anti-Muggleborn thoughts himself, but he understands the world a little bit. And while I think he didn't need to be saying this to Alex to begin with, I think he understands that if she's going to grow up and have any standing in the wizarding world the way it currently is, that who she ends up marrying will impact outsiders' opinion of her, even past what's already happening to her reputation because of who her father is. And right. So I don't think he needed to bring it up to her, but I also don't think he's a blood supremacist. I just think he understands the state of the wizarding world.
Yeah. I'm wondering, I don't know if this was answered or not, but I'm wondering who he's trying to persuade Alex to look better to. Like, kind of the Thorn side, the Thorn Circle side, or the Confederation side. And, like, you know, obviously uplifting Alex's public outlook. It's an interesting, I mean, knowing Max, it's probably people with the Thorn side, I would guess, but it's an interesting.
Well, it's an interesting dynamic because we don't really know the Thorn Circle's attitude towards Muggleborns, right? We don't even really know Governor General Huckstein's attitude towards Muggleborns. And so I think for now, Max is just doing this as like a general guideline. Like, if you're going to do this, you need to be aware of the ramifications in the future type of thing. Regardless, though, a few other things happen in Chapter 19, but nothing really all that important. They play this cool, like, wizarding magical board game that seems interesting. It reminds me very much of a game from the book series The Magicians, where you kind of manipulate elements to gain control of tiles on a game board. And Alex asks Max if he's dating Beatrice, to which he says no, he's not dating Beatrice. But other than that, there's not really a lot of information left in Chapter 19. So we can move on to Chapter 20, which is called Charlie the Thief. And as I said in the summary, this opens up with what I think would be a really cool scene to play out on the big screen with Alex in a pretty intense aerial duel with Max Martin and Beatrice. And one of my notes says that it feels maybe more intense than it needs to. Alex casts a jinx at Martin called a strangling jinx. Right? And he has to, like, forcibly remove his scarf from around his neck to stop himself from being choked to death. So it's not, like, dueling for fun. It's, like, dueling for business type of stuff.
I love Martin's response, too, of just using a summoning charm on Alex's broom, which would leave her just in the air, but she just leans into it and accelerates even faster than the spell pulls the broom directly at him. So it's fun to see. I really like it. I agree. It would be a great cinematic experience if you had a nice Warner Brothers budget to spend on it. But alas, until I win that $450 million lottery, probably not.
Yeah, you know, it's cool. It's really cool. I think what you just talked about, where he summons her broom and then she just leans into it, is a perfect illustration of Shirtliff telling Alex that she needs to stop being so offensive with her dueling and start thinking defensively, because it's a great offensive tactic on her part. It throws Martin off, but then it exposes her totally to his next jinx, which ends the duel effectively for her.
My biggest take from this was, why, obviously we don't need a deep dive into magical education and their curriculum, but like Defense Against the Dark Arts, or you have whatever this version is in this in the at Charmbridge of Defense Against the Dark Arts. A lot of that focused on, at least what we saw, and I'm primarily using, like, you know, Prisoner of Azkaban, that kind of stuff. You basically saw a lot of magical creatures, like what to do if you run into a magical creature, or some other dark, you know, trap or something like that. My question is, why, if they're really worried about dark wizards and dueling and everything, why is the only practice happening in a school setting, a dueling club that seems to, in this book and the last book, end after one session? Obviously, in this one, they have the J-Rock, which they're practicing this stuff. But, I mean, still, like, a normal student isn't going to be practicing the dueling side of things.
It's a great question, especially when you consider that essentially all the problems from the original series and that we've had in this book so far have been created by dark wizards, not by creatures.
Yeah.
So why aren't they learning to defend themselves against that stuff is a really good question.
I mean, yeah, kind of. Like, I agree that it's weird that it happens in Hogwarts, But I think this is the more normal approach as far as what I'm used to, because it wasn't like in high school any of us were required to say take self-defense classes or required to go to the gun range and learn how to fire a gun.
But our high school didn't exist in a closed universe where it's designed for with dark wizards in mind or dark people in mind, you know?
I mean, as far as this place is concerned, though, the only dark wizards they've had to deal with is the Thorn Circle, who hasn't been around in 20 years.
That's true.
And they have an active military in the whatever the J-Rock turns into.
If you take a self-defense class, you don't go in there assuming you're going to learn how to survive in the woods. You assume you're going to learn how to survive against an attacker, which defense against the dark arts, most of the dark arts you're going to face are physical attackers. So it's just funny to me how they never learned anything. They never really learned anything about what to do.
I guess we don't really necessarily see much of what Shirtless class is even like in this series, right? Because this duel, this aerial duel between Alex and Max and his friends, this is not happening in any sanctioned capacity, right? This is them going to their secret clearing in the forest and practicing with each other, kind of outside of the approval of the school.
Well, I also believe that it says after this happens, though, I can't find the exact line, but I believe it says this would not be allowed without supervision. So I don't think it's necessarily even, like, something that's banned. It's just something that, like, Shirtliff would have to be around to make sure that it's, like, safe.
Sure, but she's certainly not here for this group.
No, and I believe it also says that there's no chance a seventh grader would be allowed to partake.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This scene's cool because the Strangling Jinx, I think, is a really unique type of jinx. Max uses Levy Corpus, which we know is a spell invented by Severus Snape when he was masquerading as the Half-Blood Prince. It's assumed. I looked it up just to make sure. It's assumed to be invented by Severus Snape.
I thought that was just Sectum Sempra.
Also Levy Corpus. And then the sick part about Levy Corpus is that in Snape's worst memory, where Harry goes in the Pensieve and sees his dad bullying Snape, his dad uses Snape's own spell to humiliate him.
Oh, interesting.
And then also the worst one, in my opinion, is the seasickness curse that Max hits Beatrice with. That sounds horrible. Sounds absolutely awful.
That one would be pretty horrible. I hate puking.
But really, maybe the most important part of this is, well, there's two important things, I guess, that happen in this scene. First of all, Alex asks Beatrice if she's interested in Max, and Beatrice basically says, well, that's not going to work out. It wouldn't work out between us. But I think it's really interesting that her quote is, my family wouldn't approve for one thing, and then she never talks about what the other thing is. So I wanted you to speculate really quick, Baylor, if you don't mind. If there is an additional reason why it wouldn't work out with her and Max, what would that be? We already know that Abraham Thorne is the first reason why.
It's so speculative. I guess my thought would be it's something to do with, you know, they're teenagers, you know, 16, 17, I believe. So my thought would be it's something along the lines of that they're such good friends that they would worry if they tried doing something, dating or whatever, and it didn't work out, then they would ruin their friendship. But since it kind of was a very big point, I kind of think that it's something different than that. And I could see something would have, you know, something could have happened in the past between Beatrice and Max that makes her not want to date him.
I think that's a fair speculation.
They already dated and Beatrice's family crucioed her for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So
a little dark.
That's really interesting. But more interesting enough is that Charlie shows up and he's been stealing again.
He has an earring.
He's stolen an earring this time. He sounds annoying, kind of, to be honest.
You know, I can't remember if it was like Bangkok or something, but there's like this smuggling ring or thieving ring somewhere in Southeast Asia, and they have trained like monkeys and birds and stuff.
Yeah.
To steal for them and to like deliver messages and stuff. Charlie would be great in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, apparently, yeah. He's not even trained. But that's where the dueling scene kind of ends, and next thing we know, David wants to break up with Alex. He wants to end their fake relationship, because we come to find out, and I feel bad for the guy, not a single person will even talk to him while he's in this supposed fake relationship with Alex.
Well, he says everyone he talks to is terrified of Alex. It's crazy.
What a beta.
Also, I don't think we mentioned from the beginning, but the whole point of this fake relationship was to see if Angelique liked David and to make her jealous. And so that definitely did not happen either. So it's unfortunate for him.
It didn't, and Constance and Forbearance get their last laugh here because they come in with another fire quote saying, "What your wand works can't be undone with words." First of all, highly suggestive coming from Constance and Forbearance.
I mean, very, since they all blush afterwards, too.
Right. Like, at first you read it and you think maybe they don't know what they're saying, but then they all blush afterwards. It's really a pretty funny interaction because David says, "My wand isn't working nothing." and everybody blushes in. So it is.
Yeah.
A pretty funny interaction. However, what happens next is not funny. Darla kisses David for some reason.
That is sexual harassment.
Yeah.
Weird.
Which,
man.
Yeah. if you think about it, maybe Alex's plan did work, but with the wrong girl.
Yeah, maybe.
Alex is also toxic. I just want to point that out.
Oh, that whole plan is incredibly toxic.
Well, not only that, but as soon as she finds out Darla kissed David, she says, "Well, you did say you're not into skinny white girls, although Darla's not very skinny." She's insane, man.
Yeah,
you know. Toxic.
But the outcome of this kiss is that David ends up in the hospital wing, the infirmary, with the worst case of pimples and acne that you could possibly imagine. So bad that he has to stay there overnight and they won't go away weeks into a couple months later. And so the suspicion is that Darla cursed David, until it's not the suspicion anymore because Dean Grimm tests Darla's wand and finds out it wasn't Darla. At least it wasn't her wand that did the cursing. And so this sort of implies that she's got the older Mors Mortis boys cursing people for her a little bit.
Yeah, and I think Max kind of confirms it in their conversation at the end. Because Alex does ask Max, did Darla do this or did Darla have someone do this? And he doesn't say no, for sure.
Yeah, he doesn't say no. I think Max knows for sure what happened here, but he's not going to tell Alex because he's trying to keep that stuff away from her. But for real, if Darla did do this, like even convinced John Manuelito to curse David or something because David rejected her, she sucks, dude. Like, she already sucks. Like, we already know she sucks, but she is awful.
She's pretty bad. I want to know how many 12-year-olds have tried to cast the killing curse.
It can't be that many.
No.
You know what I mean?
Her and Bellatrix and Voldemort?
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, first there was that, and then there was the whole, you know, stealing your best friend's pet to try to put a curse on your best friend by killing the pet. And then now this, I mean, you know, Darla is obviously taking a very dark route, so to speak. And it only gets worse, not to jump ahead or anything, but.
So, I don't know. This chapter didn't have a lot going on until the very end, like we talked about. And what that is at the very end is Charlie arrives on the scene having stolen something else, a strange coin. It's not a Mors Mortis coin, however. It's an interesting coin. It's got a bird-like man on one side, and on the other side, a flat-topped hill surrounded by Styx. And he gives this to Alex, of course, which she doesn't know what the heck it is, but we find out very quickly that this coin definitely belonged to Darla.
Yep.
At one point.
Yep. She's not happy.
She freaks out in her room, right?
Yeah.
Tosses stuff all over the place, treats Angelique horribly.
Pretty sure she threatens to kill some people.
Given her reaction, I mean, it's definitely got to be something very, very either important to her and or something that if it's found, it's going to get her in some serious trouble. I mean, she even threatens to kill Alex and Anna.
She does, yeah.
She does, bizarre. Which, listen, I know they're 12. I know they're stupid. If somebody that cast the killing curse at me threatened then afterwards to kill me, I'd probably go talk to Dean Grimm.
It's worth reporting.
Yeah.
Yeah, potential. But do you think Darla could even do it?
Well, no, from what we've seen, right?
I don't know. This might be the most angry we've ever seen her. Maybe she could channel it somehow now, maybe. But... regardless, this coin has some significant importance that we don't get to read about until next week. So That's the end of chapter 20. again, overall, two easy to read, fine chapters. Just not a lot of, I think, relevant stuff until the very, very end of chapter 20.
I agree.
It'll be nice to jump back into some relevant stuff going forward. But first, we need to name some MVPs and toss out some new section titles. So,
and we have a casting that we kind of skipped over.
Oh, it's that's not right.
That important.
But we do have a casting. So let's do the MVP and name the arc, and then we'll cast
Perfect. Our
new casting. And then we'll do Baylor's prediction. Starting with MVPs, Gelbert, who was your arc MVP?
David Washington. I've been waiting a long time to give David Washington some love. He's a great character. He's kind of like sidelined most of book one, but he made some appearances and he's starting to become a little more relevant in book two. But he just seems to be a good, hardworking kid who has a crush. And because of that, these two chapters were written, basically.
Yeah. These were kind of David's chapters, which is unfortunate for him because he didn't exactly come out on top.
Right.
Baylor, who was your MVP?
So I went with Beatrice Hawthorne. And I honestly, I just thought she seems like a cool person and definitely a friend that you would want to have on your side. And then in both these chapters, chapter 19 for Max and chapter 20 for Alex, she kind of consoles both of them and calms them down. Regarding each other. And so I think she's kind of maybe fitting in. Obviously, Alex is Max's younger sister, but maybe she's kind of fitting in as kind of a younger or an older sister role thus far this book. Very, very informally.
I wanted to go with Beatrice as well because... basically, the conversation she has with Alex has, like, piqued my curiosity so much about what that other reason is for why she couldn't, why a relationship with her and Max wouldn't work out. So I think she's a great choice as far as MVP goes. My MVP this week is Charlie the Raven, because he's driving the plot forward. He's kind of given us a new intriguing event to look forward to going into the second half of the book, since sort of all the lead up to the conversation with Abraham Thorne is over with now. So that's why I went with Charlie the Raven this go around.
That's fair. He did just have a chat with Hagar, too.
Yeah.
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 Second time in this book that he's done that.
Good for Charlie. Now, renaming the Ark, as always, I'll say mine first. However, I think it's okay this time.
I agree.
My new title for this arc, for these two chapters, would be Jealous Intentions. Because they were trying to make Angelique jealous, and it led to some other intentions from Darla. So that would be my name. Baylor, what would yours be?
I threw an ode to Harry Potter, the original series, and I said Darla Demented, because using the British slang definition of demented, it means driven to behave irrationally due to anger, distress, or excitement.
So. This whole book could be called Darla Demented.
Alexandra Quick and Darla Demented.
Exactly. I think it's a great title. Delbert, I'm in. What was yours?
I went with TV tropes, but wanted to separate the two. So TV and tropes.
It's a great title if you're not... If you've read the chapter and didn't just listen to our podcast.
Right.
There's a lot of mention in the chapter about how David thinks Alex watches too much TV, and that's why her plan doesn't work.
That's how the whole plan comes about, is she thinks through TV shows that she's seen where they make a girl jealous by dating someone else, that that's going to be the way the plan works.
Indeed.
Yep.
Three pretty good titles this go around, I think. Not bad.
Pretty good.
I'm a fan of Baylor's, I gotta say.
I am also a fan of Baylor's. Pretty good. Great. Yeah. It's great. I can't wait to see it in the feed. Now for the casting, Delbert.
Yes, so we kind of skipped over it because he's not super prominent. However, it was Brady that said he wants to see this on the big screen and we need an actor to cover him, so we're going with Martin Wynn. I believe that's how his last name is pronounced.
It is.
Brady, how about you start us off?
Well, I only know one thing about him, really.
Beautiful.
He's Vietnamese.
Nice.
And so, looking for Vietnamese actors, I found, and I don't know how you pronounce this name, the last name anyways, William Ngo, I think.
N-G-O.
N-G-O, Ngo, I think is how you pronounce it. I tried to look it up, but I'm not a native speaker of Vietnamese, so it is what it is. Things that he's been in. He's been in a show called Staircase, a show called Boy Erased. He's been in The Vampire Diaries. That's pretty exciting stuff. He's in Marvel's Runaways. And he's in Fuller House. So he's been in some stuff that I at least recognize. And so he's going to be my choice for Martin Wynn.
Now, I'm going to leave Baylor until last so he can salvage the casting segment. Because, unsurprisingly, I went with an athlete as my casting. I did this once with Josh Allen, but hear me out and tell me if it's any better. I went with a gentleman, and once again, pronunciation may be off, but I believe Kung Lee. And Brady, here's a picture of him.
Kung Lee, maybe?
Maybe.
Yeah, he's jacked.
Now, that's not the actual picture I care about. I think this one's a little more fitting.
Sure.
But he is a former mixed martial artist and fighter for the UFC. However, he also is a film star.
He has...
Who was in Walker, Texas Ranger. Who was in Tekken. Who was in Hawaii Five-0.
Hawaii Five-0, that's pretty cool.
He's a Yakuza member there. Which is... You know, kind of a cool, like, non-credited role.
Sure.
So I went with him. I know he's, like, more an athlete than an actor, but at least, as opposed to Josh Allen, he is an actor. So, a little bit better than the last time I cast an athlete. Baylor, how about you save me?
I went with someone who is also Vietnamese. Also, interestingly enough, has the same last name as Martin. So
it's
that's
a popular
exciting.
Last name. I believe.
That's very cool. I'm glad. But I went with Johnny Try Win. And if you don't know who that is, that's fine, because I also don't very well. He has been in a couple big-ish movies, I would say. For example, The Rebel in 2007, Power Kids in 2009. He was in the original Spider-Man. He was also in X-Men First Class. I believe he has a recognizable face, so perhaps you've seen him before.
I feel like I certainly have. Again, casting child actors of a specific ethnicity is tough.
Yeah.
I mean. So we've gone with three adults here.
Yeah.
Who will have to be de-aged. But regardless of that, that's the casting of old Martin Wynn, which means we only have one thing left to do, Baylor, and that's to do the prediction segment. So, if you don't mind, remind us of your prediction from last week regarding these two chapters.
It is going to be horrible.
It is bad. I remember that.
So for my prediction, I believe that Alex and David will put into action Alex's plan to see if Angelique likes David. The chapter is titled Dangerous Hearts because David gets let down by Angelique and is heartbroken. In the next chapter, Charlie will once again steal a Morse Mortis Society coin. But this time, instead of a map to get to the Morse Mortis Society meetings, the coin will have a simple message on it. Maximilian is in the lands below.
To be honest, you smoked chapter 19 right on the
forehead. Better than I remember, yeah. I thought it was a total blunder, but that chapter 19 is pretty accurate.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
Chapter 20, however, is not that close. Charlie does steal a coin.
Max did go down to the valley floor, which is the land below Charmbridge.
That's true. That is true. I think I'm a 5 across the board on this one. Just because you did really good for chapter 19, and then chapter 20, it was like, well, not really.
I feel like it was very, very accurate for 19. Like, maybe not perfect, but very close.
You know what? I'm going to go 6, actually.
And a total miss on the second. I'm going to your 5. I think it was nearly perfect and nearly the worst.
I'm going to go to a 6 because I understand the difficulty of making these predictions, so I'm going to wait this grade in your favor a little bit.
Excellent. That's strange, since last week you said if the test says 2 plus 2 and he gets the answer right, we shouldn't take away points.
Yeah, you know, but...
But college, right?
Grading stuff is not meant to be a consistent practice. It's meant
a 5
to be
from me, dog.
Whatever the easiest for the teacher is.
It's a Randy Jackson 5.
Okay, well, for me it's a 6. For me, it's a Martina McBride 6. All right.
Now, I don't know if you could go from Randy Jackson, who says dog a lot, into Martina McBride, of all people. I don't think that's how that works.
Baylor, next week's, we're going to be discussing chapters 21 and 22 of this book. Chapter 21 is titled The Obel, and chapter 22 is titled 13. Do you have questions for us?
I do. And I wanted to start with Delbert today. Delbert, what is an obel?
An obel is a mythological coin that may or may not provide passage across the River Styx.
The River Styx. Interesting. Okay, Brady, does something happen to Alex on her birthday, assuming that's what the chapter title 13 is referring to?
Well, it is referring to her birthday. I'm thinking you're saying, does something happen to her in a negative light? And the answer is no. Nothing happens to Alex on her birthday aside from getting, among other gifts, a sweet gift from Max.
Excellent. Let me think about this for a second. A minute or 6. So for my prediction, things will become clearer regarding Darla's situation. Knowing that the obel was hers and has to deal with the River Styx, Alex and company will begin to connect the dots about what has been influencing Darla thus far this year. Furthermore, in order to either get the oval back or try and find who has it, Darla will have to reveal her intention for Alex or others to someone or Alex, if that makes sense. I.e., she will have to hint at what she is planning this year, like why she's doing what she's doing. Regarding the 13 chapter, Alex will have her birthday and turn 13, obviously. Knowing Max gets her an awesome gift, I personally think it will be an ode to Prisoner of Azkaban and will be a new broomstick, given also their duels last chapter. Given that it's her birthday, I also think that Abraham Thorne will make another appearance. And then finally, Alex will continue practicing and getting to know Martin and Beatrice.
Okay. A very long prediction.
Indeed. This one was 7 bullets, yes.
Well thought out, I believe, but quite long. So we will grade that next week, I suppose, Delbert.
Yes, I'd also like to make a correction.
Okay.
I made a dog joke about Randy Jackson and Martina McBride. I get Martina McBride and Sarah McLachlan mixed up, and I believe Sarah McLachlan was, like, bitten pretty bad by a dog once.
Okay.
Which is why that joke was made and made no sense.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
Martina McBride, famed country singer.
Yeah.
We'll see if you wrong me here in the next few days, or else I'll cut this part out and then leave your confusing joke.
That way you just the look editor's like a bingo. Threat.
All right, that's gonna do it for this episode, I think. You guys have anything else to say just quickly?
If you're 62 and you're a racist, we don't like you.
Yes. If you're 62 and a racist, we get it together, pal.
Any age. I think the age is
interchangeable. Anna gets a pass.
Now, hold on. You're starting to sound like you're justifying racism in some way.
Me?
Yes.
Listen, okay. We're getting too far into my life again, but when I grew up from like ages 6...
That's going to do it for the podcast.
6 to 12.
As always,
I had a very close friend.
Next Sunday.
And he called me Kraka all the time.
My name, or as always, I've been Brady.
I've been Kraka.
I've been Baylor.
We'll see you next Sunday. Have a great night.